Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
This is Microsoft's gorgeous new Nest competitor, by Lisa Edesico. Microsoft's vision for the smart home is finally taking shape. Following a demonstration of how its Cortana virtual system would work in cars and living rooms last May, the company just revealed it's working on a smart thermostat called Glass. The device was built by Johnson Controls and is powered by Microsoft technologies like its Azure cloud platform, Cortana voice helper, and Windows IoT Core, a version of Windows 10 that's optimized for smaller devices. The company unveiled Glass in a new YouTube video that offers a brief overview of what it's up to. Contrasted with rivals like the Nest Learning Thermostat and Honeywell Lyric, both of which have round shapes that resemble more traditional thermostats, Glass appears to be a sleek, transparent touchscreen mounted on a wall. It can tell when a user is present in a room as well as monitor air quality, then change its settings accordingly. Based on the video, it looks like owners will be able to set the thermostat to different modes, such as home or away, and can program the system to auto, heat, or cool. The screen can also be used to summarize energy savings, display a calendar, and outline air quality. This isn't the first time Microsoft has worked with a partner to further its presence in the smart home. In late 2016, the company touted its Invoke speaker, an Amazon Echo alternative made by Harman Kardon that supports Cortana. With its Glass announcement, Microsoft seems to be approaching the Internet of Things market in step with its PC business, by shopping out its software platforms to partners that can build the hardware. The news also comes as an increasing number of home devices are adding support for Amazon's Alexa virtual assistant. Microsoft has not yet revealed pricing or availability.
Trump administration brings Al-Qaeda suspect to the U.S. to face civilian court, by the Associated Press. An Al-Qaeda suspect linked to a plot to kill a Swedish cartoonist has been brought to Philadelphia from Spain to face terrorism charges. Court officials say Ali Sharaf Dimash of Algeria appeared in court Friday and will be arraigned next week. U.S. prosecutors say Dimash married a Colorado woman who traveled to Ireland to meet him in 2009. They say Jamie Paulin Ramirez eventually helped the FBI investigate a terror cell that included a Pennsylvania woman known as Jihad Jane online. Dimash, known as Black Flag, had been fighting extradition. Officials say the cell wanted to kill a cartoonist who had offended Muslims. The Trump administration will try Dimash in civilian court rather than send him to the prison at Guantanamo Bay, a hardline approach favored by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Thor's Tessa Thompson on why her action hero icon is Terminator's Sarah Connor, by Eliana Doctorman. Tessa Thompson never expected to be at San Diego Comic-Con. The actor, who is known for her roles as a college radio DJ challenging her classmates on issues of race in Dear White People, and a singer who falls for Michael B. Jordan's boxer in Creed, watched superhero movies growing up but could never relate to them. Catwoman was really important to me because she was a woman who looks like me who can occupy that space, she says. But besides her, I didn't really see myself in these films. Except now she's playing a strong woman in two genre projects, an executive cleaning up the mess at an android-filled theme park in HBO's Westworld, and an intergalactic warrior in Thor, Ragnarok. Thompson spoke to Time at Comic-Con about why it's important to have a diverse array of characters in these roles, how she tried to get in shape, like Terminator 2's Sarah Connor for Thor, and why she's questioning whether her character is human or host in Westworld. How do you feel about the state of female action heroes right now? With Atomic Blonde and Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel being introduced and all the wonderful ladies in the Marvel Universe right now, it seems like we're having a moment. But while it's very exciting to play a character that can wield a sword, I think what's important is more female characters that are complex and dynamic and layered. That's happening more in cinema and definitely more on television, which is why it's an honor to work with women like Evan, Rachel Wood, and Tandy Newton on Westworld. You play a warrior in Thor, Ragnarok. I read that you tried to become as strong as Sarah Connor in Terminator 2 for the role. What inspired that? Taika Waititi, the director, inspired that. I got cast and I asked if there was a reference for her. At the time, I was working in London on this movie, Annihilation, and I was working with a swordsman who also trained Gal Gadot for Wonder Woman. But I also had to figure out for Thor what I wanted to look like physically. And Taika sends me this picture of Sarah Connor. I was like, yeah, right, man, she looks unreal. But I wanted to gain weight, gain muscle. Valkyrie is strong like Thor. Chris is in really good shape and also just a huge human, so I didn't want to look too small next to him because the character I'm playing holds her own with him. I always wanted to feel strong so I could feel confident enough to embody her. So yes, now I can do pull-ups. As long as I can do as many pull-ups as Sarah Connor did on screen, I'm good. Why is that important for you to be a part of a movie like that? When I first got the call to sit down with Taika about playing Valkyrie, I was so excited because I am such a fan of his films. They're so singular, but I was really shocked because I didn't grow up watching genre films or superhero films, seeing people who looked like me in those movies. Catwoman was really important to me because she was a woman who looks like me who can occupy that space, but besides her, I didn't really see myself in these films. And I think you do have to see it to believe it. That's why it's so amazing that moms are sending me messages that they're so excited to buy this Valkyrie doll for their daughters because she looks like her. And people are sending me these cosplay pictures of Valkyrie. Not all of them are brown, by the way. You can relate to people that are so different than you. That's why it's so important. Fans of Westworld are now questioning whether every character is a human or a host. Does creating that sense of mystery affect your acting choices on the show? I think creators Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy are so smart in their treatment of us on Westworld. For example, Jeffrey Wright didn't know he was AI until he got that script, and none of us knew either. I think that changed everything when we read that episode. It forced us to question our reality. All the actors playing humans were suddenly like, wait, am I a human though? It was brilliant because if Jeffrey had known he was playing AI, he might have wanted to add an affectation to it. Instead, he believed, just like the character Bernard, that he was human, and he went through the same experience the character went through. So, are you AI? It had occurred to me before then that I could potentially be AI. Since that episode, I'm now convinced that I am. Part of me is praying that I'm not because I don't want to spend all year nude. But the actors are guessing as much as the audience. We get redacted scripts. Only Anthony Hopkins and Evan Rachel Wood knew what was going to happen in the final episode of last season. So you captured actors being shocked by what they were seeing as the characters were. We are starting the second season now, and I've read only one episode. How has the show changed your relationship to technology? I think it's made me conscientious, and I've been thinking a lot about the central question of the show. What do we as humans do when we think there's no emotional cost? How do we treat the hosts? It makes me think about our treatment of the Earth. We're actively causing climate change when we don't consider the cost.
Six killed in violent clashes in Jerusalem, by Mohammed Daragma and Karen Laub for the Associated Press in Jerusalem. Escalating Israeli-Palestinian tensions over the Holy Land's most contested shrine boiled over into violence on Friday that killed six people, three Palestinians in street clashes in Jerusalem, and three Israelis in a stabbing attack at a West Bank settlement. After nightfall, a Palestinian sneaked into a home in the Israeli settlement of Halamish in the West Bank and stabbed to death three Israelis, the head of Israel's rescue service said. An Israeli news site said those killed were two men and a woman who were having dinner at the time. The army released footage showing a blood-covered kitchen floor. Israel TV's Channel 10 said the assailant was in his late teens and had posted on Facebook that he was upset by the events at the shrine. Eli Bean, the head of Israel's rescue service, MDA, said an off-duty soldier next door heard screams, rushed to the home, and shot the attacker through a window. Bean said the attacker was wounded and evacuated to hospital. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, meanwhile, announced that he is freezing ties with Israel, dealing a blow to fledgling Trump administration efforts to try to renew long-dormant peace talks. Abbas said contacts with Israel would be suspended on all levels.
It was not immediately clear if this means long-standing security coordination between Israeli troops and Abbas's forces will be halted. At issue in the current round of violence are metal detectors Israel installed at the Jerusalem Shrine earlier this week in response to a deadly attack by Arab gunmen there. The metal detectors are perceived by the Palestinians as an encroachment on Muslim rights and portrayed by Israel as a needed security measure following the attack that killed two Israeli policemen. Earlier Friday, several thousand Palestinians in Jerusalem and the West Bank clashed with Israeli troops, burning tires or throwing stones and firecrackers. Troops fired live rounds, rubber bullets, and tear gas. Three Palestinians were killed and several dozen hospitalized with live or rubber bullet injuries. White clouds of tear gas rose from Jerusalem streets and West Bank flashpoints. In one neighborhood, Palestinians threw stones from behind a mattress used as a shield. Israel also faced growing criticism from the Muslim world, and thousands staged anti-Israel protests after Friday prayers in Jordan and Yemen. Turkey and Egypt also condemned the violence. The confrontations in the Holy Land could escalate in coming days as both sides dig in. Israel said the metal detectors would remain in place. Lawmaker Tzachi Hanegbi, a confidant of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said Israel would not surrender to what he said were violence and incitement by those attempting to drag us into a religious war. Jerusalem's top Muslim cleric, Mohammed Hussein, said protests, including mass street prayers outside the shrine, would continue until the devices are removed. He told worshippers Friday that they should prepare for a long test of wills with Israel. "We will not back off," he said. The shrine, revered by Muslims and Jews, sits at the emotional epicenter of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, symbolizing the rival religious and national narratives of the two sides. Disputes over the 37-acre walled hilltop platform in Jerusalem's Old City have repeatedly triggered major confrontations in the past. Earlier this week, Israel began installing metal detectors at the gates of the compound, saying extra measures were required to prevent further attacks. Muslim leaders portrayed the metal detectors as part of a purported Israeli campaign to expand its control over the shrine, a claim Israel denies. Muslim clerics urged worshippers to pray in the streets near the shrine rather than submit to the new security procedures. The faithful complied. Thousands flocked to the Old City each day this week for street prayers, kneeling on mats spread on cobblestone and asphalt. On Friday, the highlight of the Muslim religious week, Israeli police severely restricted Muslim access to the Old City to prevent mass protests. Some 3,000 officers were deployed at checkpoints in and around the city, turning away Muslim men under the age of 50, including those trying to reach the city from Israel and the West Bank. In the end, thousands reached the Old City, a fraction of the typical Friday turnout of tens of thousands of worshippers. After peaceful prayers, clashes erupted in several areas of Jerusalem and across the West Bank. Palestinian health officials said three Palestinians were killed by live fire in different areas of Jerusalem. The Red Crescent said 390 Palestinians were hurt, including close to 100 who were hospitalized for live fire or rubber bullet injuries. Israeli police said five officers were wounded. The perceived threat to the shrine, home to the Al-Aqsa and Dome of the Rock mosques, has galvanized Palestinians, especially those in East Jerusalem, which was captured by Israel in the 1967 Mideast War and quickly annexed. Since 1967, Israel has increasingly cut off East Jerusalem from its West Bank hinterland, leaving the city's Arab residents without a political leadership. Muslim clerics stepped into the void this week, taking the lead in prayer protests. Under the post-1967 arrangements, Muslims administer the compound. Jews can visit but not pray there. For decades, the status quo held, in part because leading rabbis, citing religious purity laws, banned Jews from entering. In recent years, religious opinion has shifted, and growing numbers of Jews are visiting the compound. This shift has stoked Muslim fears of a purported Israeli plan to expand Jewish control there. Israel has reiterated that it has no intention to change the status quo. Fakhri Abu Diab, a 55-year-old worshiper, said he feels Muslims must stand their ground. If we let them, they, the Israelis, will take over the mosque completely, he said, standing near the old city. If we resist them, they will stop. The dispute over the detectors has led to rising tensions between Israel and the Muslim world. The compound is the third holiest site of Islam, after Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. It is also Judaism's holiest site, once home to biblical temples. Jordan, the custodian of the Jerusalem shrine, has repeatedly appealed to Israel to remove the devices. The two countries cooperate closely on regional security issues, but frequently disagree on Israel's policies at the shrine. On Friday, several thousand Jordanians protested against Israel in the Jordanian capital of Amman. Demonstrators chanted, "The people want to liberate Al-Aqsa," referring to one of the mosques in the compound. Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim said his country is in touch with Israeli officials to try to end the crisis. Speaking in Ankara after Friday prayers, he called Israel's security measures radical, saying limits imposed on Muslim prayers would not contribute to a solution. Game of Thrones creators defend new HBO show about slavery amid backlash. By Melissa Chan. The creators of Game of Thrones, who are developing a new show for HBO that reimagines the outcome of the Civil War and depicts a modern world in which slavery remains legal in the South, defended the controversial series as it drew fierce backlash. During an extensive interview alongside executive producers Nichelle Tramble Spellman and Malcolm Spellman on Thursday, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss said they're terrified but excited to work on a show that envisions a present-day America after the South successfully seceded from the Union during the Civil War. The upcoming science fiction series, Confederate, sparked intense outrage online after HBO announced it was in the works Wednesday. Many said it was tone-deaf for two white men to be at the forefront of a show about enslaving black people. Benioff and Weiss have also been previously criticized over the lack of diversity on Game of Thrones. Logan Rapp tweeted, "Two white guys making a show where black slavery features prominently? This is profoundly tone-deaf." And from Roxanne Gay, "It is exhausting to think of how many people at HBO said yes to letting two white men envision modern-day slavery, and offensive." The two showrunners said the series is a different but necessary way to discuss the past. "It goes without saying slavery is the worst thing that ever happened in American history," Weiss told Vulture. "It's our original sin as a nation, and history doesn't disappear. One of the strengths of science fiction is that it can show us how this history is still with us in a way no strictly realistic drama ever could," he added. "It's an ugly and a painful history, but we all think this is a reason to talk about it, not a reason to run from it. And this feels like a potentially valuable way to talk about it." The series will also be produced and written by Nichelle Tramble Spellman and Malcolm Spellman, who are both black. Malcolm Spellman told Vulture the series will not feature whips and plantations, since it takes place in present time. "For me and Nichelle, it's deeply personal because we are the offspring of this history," Malcolm Spellman said. "We deal with it directly and have for our entire lives. As people of color and minorities in general are starting to get a voice, I think there's a duty to force this discussion." Benioff urged patience from the public until the first episode airs. "This is scary for all of us," he said. "It's scary for different reasons, but it is a pretty terrifying prospect getting into it. We knew it would be, and now it's come true." HBO said production will begin after the final season of Game of Thrones. Democrats are more upset about losing Melissa McCarthy impression than losing Sean Spicer. By Eric Jenkins. Press Secretary Sean Spicer abruptly resigned from his position Friday, sending shockwaves through Washington. As the news began to spread, a number of Democratic politicians weighed in on Spicer's departure, which was prompted by President Donald Trump's decision to name New York financier Anthony Scaramucci as communications director, a move Spicer and others within the Trump administration opposed. Some Democrats said they would miss Melissa McCarthy's impression of Spicer on Saturday Night Live more than they would miss the actual press secretary. Here are some of the reactions from Democrats on Twitter. Representative Maxine Waters: congratulations, Sean Spicer. You've got more guts than Jeff Sessions. Representative Karen Bass: I'm very saddened and disappointed that Melissa McCarthy will no longer serve on SNL. Thank you, Press Secretary, for your contributions. Representative Raul Grijalva: the real travesty is that this means goodbye to fake Sean Spicer, Melissa McCarthy. Representative Mark Vesey: I guess a six-month stint of telling alternative facts was all Sean Spicer could handle. Melissa McCarthy must also be out of her SNL job. Well, we'll always have YouTube. Representative Lacey Clay: bye-bye, Spicy. We'll really miss Melissa McCarthy on SNL. Representative Yvette Clark: chaos as usual in the Trump White House. Representative Don Beyer: 6 months in, the White House is in total chaos. These people are supposed to improve health care, repair infrastructure, and pass tax reform? Representative Jerry Connolly: what will Melissa do on SNL? Let us not forget, he was told to lie about crowd sizes and attack the media, was left in the dark on major POTUS meetings. But this was a step too far? And another tweet from Connolly: this is the way of Trump world. Lie for him, weaken press freedoms, defend the indefensible, destroy your own reputation, then be discarded. In Trump's reality TV presidency, Sean Spicer was the GOAT, by Daniel Diodario. If former Apprentice star Donald Trump's presidency can more or less be understood through the cliches of reality TV, Sean Spicer was the classic GOAT. That is to say, if Spicer, who resigned his post as White House press secretary July 21st, were on Survivor or Big Brother, he'd be the sort of contestant whose presence in the competition is good news for everyone else. If you're a reality TV contestant, you want to bring a GOAT as deep into the game as you can before cutting them loose. Unschooled in strategy, they'll vote how you tell them, and they're always an easy boot. Simple ineptitude is too quotidian for the GOAT. Such players seem, in part due to savvy editing, to be almost confused as to the rules of the game. When he spoke on camera, Spicer did so live, so he can't blame the editors. But the format, early in Trump's presidency, a daily briefing that came to be must-watch TV for a certain type of news consumer, was certainly not his friend. As a character in the daily Trumpland drama, Spicer managed to make banality stand out. In suits that seemed to grip his body like a vice, and with his flushing face, the press liaison rose to levels of dudgeon over petty offenses. As a TV figure, he radiated a sort of anti-charisma that gave watching him, for his detractors, a nasty, vicarious thrill. In contrast to the zenned-out sangfroid of administration figures like Kellyanne Conway and Ivanka Trump, Spicer seemed to pulsate off the screen. It was electric, strange, and very watchable, precisely the things that candidate Trump had been. But the cover act was being carried out by someone with specific job requirements, ones that seemed not to be met. Those in the briefing room with him did not seem to particularly enjoy the experience. Spicer's very early argument with the press corps over the size of Trump's inauguration audience didn't just set a tone, it was a battering ram. Other press secretaries cajole or trade favors, but this one, seemingly unprepared to bridge his past work experience at more traditional political gigs with a new boss's very particular demands, convinced himself that brute force would win the game. When it didn't, Spicer lacked the flexibility to find a new strategy, heightening a beleaguered rage whine that had already failed to find a sympathetic ear in the mainstream media. It's easy to read Spicer's performance, and now his departure, as another black eye for a presidency that's lost substantial ground in public opinion polling. Certainly, Melissa McCarthy's bravura impression of Spicer on Saturday Night Live stuck in many viewers' memories. And yet, his lack of acuity during the first 6 months of a presidency with very ambitious goals for reshaping America was addressed in various ways, including by taking the briefings off air entirely. That result would seem to neatly coincide with what would be the goals of a presidency dedicated to operating in secrecy. The ultimate purpose of a reality TV GOAT, after all, is to advance the goals of those players who know what they're doing. How breakout R&B star SZA went from sharing a futon to finding her voice, by Reza Bruner. The artist SZA, born Solana Rowe and raised in New Jersey, didn't always plan to be a singer. And for a while, it looked like her breakthrough debut album, Control, might be lost in production. But sometimes fate works in mysterious ways, even for a self-described control freak like SZA. Control, released in June, has been sitting comfortably at or near the top of the R&B charts. It garnered her a widely lauded solo performance at the BET Awards and a passionate new fan base. After collaborating with prominent rappers like Kendrick Lamar and Travis Scott, the once hesitant artist is now finding her place in the music industry, even though after months spent sleeping on a futon, she still hasn't furnished her own apartment. SZA's languid R&B offers a wealth of contradictions, self-assured in delivery but insecure in emotion, casual in tone but cutting in content. "Why is it so hard to accept the party is over?" she asks on Drew Barrymore. "You came with your new friends and her mom jeans and her new Benz, and she's perfect and I hate it. Oh, so glad you made it." It's a love-hate story, equal parts twisted and relatable. In the wake of her album's success, SZA talked to Time about the process of self-discovery in making Control, the impact of working with icons like Rihanna, "We talk all the time," and Drew Barrymore, "She just radiates this air of confidence," and how she plans to approach her music moving forward. Time, this album's been a long time coming for you. What was the process like of bringing it to life? SZA, "This is just my prerequisite, honestly. This is just my entry chord into even understanding how to write." "What were you working on before? How is this different?" "I was touching music from a standpoint of, I wondered what I sounded like. I didn't know what my sound was. I didn't know my style. I didn't know how I would process music or information. I didn't know about myself, so I took the time to learn." What about your background has had an impact on your music? Were your parents into it, your friends, or was it an independent process of discovery for you? "Music kind of came out of nowhere for everybody. My parents just wanted me to be free. They thought I would be dancing, not necessarily music. So I think everyone was very unsure what this hobby was about." "Did you feel like you had to prove something to people who didn't believe in you from the beginning?" "Maybe. I think at first I was operating off of pure revenge because I was tired of, I don't know, people thought I was so whack. I was like, what? What do you mean by that? People just did not think highly of me at all. People thought maybe I was a product of nepotism or a very lucky situation or like some fucking weird night. I was sharing a futon 6 months ago. There was nothing lucky or fortuitous or nepotistic about it. People see you come out of the Staples Center with Kendrick on a set and they think, you're not living on the floor. But that's not true. Just because you know Kendrick Lamar and you also sing and you're also signed to a similar label, it literally doesn't mean anything for you. So I just wanted to establish myself as my own person." What was the turning point where things started becoming clearer for you? "I don't think it ever became clear. When this album came out, I cried. I screamed and I cried. I was so embarrassed. I thought no one would like it." The response has been overwhelmingly positive, especially from women and young women of color who connect with the themes and personal lyrics of your songs. Did you set out to write an album that's personal? Where did it come from? "I mean, no. I really don't even think it was that personal. I think it was pretty surface level for what I could do. I think this was me being afraid to go there in a lot of ways, just me dipping my toe in. Now I know that people don't mind. I can really not be afraid to become a better writer, to get my song structure together, to make it work." You include snippets of your mom's voice and your grandma giving you advice. Why? "I think I got my obsession with control from my mom. My granny is salty and sweet. She is much more like me, while my mother is just like the sweetest, most pure. I've never heard her gossip about a single person in my entire life, ever. She's an internal optimist. And my granny, she's just like, fuck it, you might as well do what you want." Why Drew Barrymore? She also cameoed in your music video for the song. How did that come together? I love Drew Barrymore. She's quirky. She's different. When she came out, there was nobody like her. She just radiates this air of confidence and also acceptance of her quirks. It's very inspiring. I always think of Ivy and Never Been Kissed and all those really 90s movies. When I heard those chords for the song, the boys made it from scratch, I was like, shit. I was like, God, this is so sad. It sounds like Freddie Prinze Jr. is about to pop out. What's changed for you now? What do you want to do next? I want to learn the fine line between taking it seriously and taking it not too seriously. I think very great people take it seriously, but not too seriously. And I think I take it so seriously that I was like, I don't even want to do this if I don't excel. I didn't even want to put my album out unless people really liked it. I wanted to quit because I was like, no one's going to like this fucking album. Now I just feel like, okay, I want to be here. I understand how to be here. Well, I don't understand how to be here, but I understand how to tap into a portion of myself while I'm here. So I might as well tap into that source in myself until I don't have anything else to tap, and then I'll do something else. How does faith impact your music? Your stage name is an acronym derived from the Supreme Alphabet and represents words for self-knowledge, enlightenment, and God. I think faith in something better or more powerful or with more knowledge and with divine order helps me trust the process. Even when I don't trust the process very well, because I'm very skittish, it forces me to trust the process. It's very weird that God has designed the whole situation for me. If you left it to me, this would not be going this way. I would have never put an album out. Who knows? You know what's crazy? I'm so tired of talking about myself. And I think that music now is a place where I can speak and then not speak. So I think on my next album, I'll just say a lot more. Cities say they haven't approved Elon Musk's East Coast Hyperloop by Eric Jenkins. It was the tweet heard round the Northeast Corridor. Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk said Thursday that the Boring Company, a side project of his focused on tunneling infrastructure, received verbal government approval to construct an underground Hyperloop route from New York City to Washington, D.C. The trip would take just 29 minutes, Musk said, with up to a dozen or more entry-exit elevators in each city. The Hyperloop is a yet unproven high-speed train concept that would theoretically be able to travel over 700 miles an hour. Musk said the route would serve four cities, New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. But when contacted by Fortune, representatives for these cities said they have not approved such a project. Moreover, they also said they have not yet held substantive discussions on the proposal. This is the first we've heard of it, but we can't wait to hear more, LaToya Foster, press secretary for the mayor of Washington, D.C., told Fortune. Elon Musk has made no contact with Philadelphia officials on this matter. We do not know what he means when he says he received verbal government approval, said Mike Dunn, deputy communications director at the city of Philadelphia. Right now, I would characterize any conversations as preliminary and not extensive, said Anthony McCarthy, director of communications for the Baltimore mayor's office. He added that the city of Baltimore has not given Musk or the Boring Company approval for the project. This is news to City Hall, said New York City Press Secretary Eric Phillips in a tweet about Musk's announcement. He later added, "The entirety of what we know about this proposal is what's in Mr. Musk's tweet. That is not how we evaluate projects of any scale." Phillips' deputy added that Musk must be joking. The White House did not confirm Musk's tweet either. "We have had promising conversations to date, are committed to transformative infrastructure projects, and believe our greatest solutions have often come from the ingenuity and drive of the private sector," the White House said in a statement to the New York Times. Shortly after his original message and facing a flurry of questions on the matter, Musk walked back his announcement. "Still a lot of work needed to receive formal approval, but am optimistic that will occur rapidly," he tweeted about an hour and a half after his original post. Musk later appeared to be drumming up support for the measure, tweeting that, "If you want this to happen fast, please let your local and federal elected representatives know. Makes a big difference if they hear from you." From where Musk may have received his verbal government approval remains unknown. A Boring Company spokesperson told Fortune that the project has received support from key government decision makers, but did not provide further specifics. If Musk could indeed build a high-speed route between the United States' economic and political centers, it could be a game-changer for the East Coast. But he would first need approval from a great many number of agencies and other stakeholders, as urbanist and Massachusetts Institute of Technology doctoral student Yona Freemark pointed out. Approval needed from federal Department of Transportation, 6 states, 17 counties, numerous cities, hundreds of elected officials, said Freemark on Twitter. Definitely happening rapidly. Musk has demonstrated a unique knack for overcoming expectations, but even he may not be able to beat City Hall. John McCain has been diagnosed with glioblastoma. What is that? By Kate Samuelson. Senator John McCain, the Republican from Arizona who ran for the presidency against Barack Obama in 2008, has been diagnosed with brain cancer, his office said July 19th. The veteran senator, 80, was undergoing surgery to have a blood clot removed from above his left eye on Friday when doctors discovered a brain tumor called glioblastoma. Here's what you need to know about the aggressive tumor. What is glioblastoma? Glioblastoma can occur in many areas of the brain and is highly invasive within the central nervous system because the cells reproduce very quickly. It's a type of glioma, a brain or spinal tumor that arises from glial cells. Glioblastoma makes up about half of all malignant brain tumors and affects around 5 people out of 100,000 per year. How are they caused? That's little understood, although genetic or environmental factors are not believed to contribute greatly to this kind of tumor. Glioblastoma is thought to arise spontaneously, Dr. Elizabeth Stoll, a research fellow at the UK's University of Newcastle's Institute of Neuroscience, told Time in a telephone interview. It really can hit anybody, she added. Like many other cancers, age is a factor in glioma incidence and malignancy. It's thought the accumulation of mutations in cells over time can contribute to causing spontaneous tumors, Dr. Stoll said. Like many cancers, you're more likely to get it when you're older. Glioblastoma can occur at any age, although the number of incidents can increase with age. What are the symptoms? The symptoms of glioblastoma are usually caused by increased pressure in the brain, according to the American Brain Tumor Association, ABTA. These symptoms are generally neurological, including seizures, headaches, dizziness, and nausea. Some patients may develop other symptoms, such as feeling weak on one side of their body, difficulties with memory and/or speech, and visual changes, the ABTA says. What's the typical prognosis? The median survival rate is about 14 to 14 and a half months, up from 8 to 12 months in recent years, and with current treatment, about 5% of patients make it to 5 years or more, Dr. Stoll told Time. It's a very difficult diagnosis, she added. What treatment is available? There are 3 main treatments available. Surgical resection, in other words, having as much of the brain tumor removed as possible via a roughly half-day surgical procedure, chemotherapy, and radiotherapy, which can be very targeted to the brain, reducing radiation exposure to other parts of the brain and the body. There are therapies inching forward and much more experimental therapies under clinical and preclinical investigation, Dr. Stoll said. There are ongoing clinical trials and research in labs trying to help identify new drugs. We're hoping to develop new options to help these patients. McCain's office said in a statement that the senator and his family are reviewing further treatment options with his Mayo Clinic care team and that his treatment options may include a combination of chemotherapy and radiation. Doctors say a third of dementia cases could be prevented. By Alice Park. Dementia, which includes Alzheimer's disease, is one of the biggest health concerns for aging people. Health officials estimate that 47 million people around the world currently live with dementia. Triple that number might be affected by 2050. For any condition, including dementia, any ways to prevent it before it can cause symptoms or damage is the most reliable way to control it. And that prevention doesn't always have to come in the form of a pill, vaccine, or liquid drug. In a report published in the journal Lancet, researchers say that 1 in 3 cases of dementia might be prevented if people start practicing good health habits beginning in childhood. The group of 24 experts reviewed all of the available data carefully and found that 1/3 of dementia cases could be avoided. They identified 9 key factors to preventing brain decline, including getting a consistent education, avoiding smoking, and keeping blood pressure and obesity under control. Focusing on factors that can prevent dementia is an exciting strategy for brain researchers, especially when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, a form of dementia linked to the buildup of amyloid protein plaques in the brain. At the recent Alzheimer's Association International Conference, researchers presented data involving a broader range of potential factors that could prevent Alzheimer's, such as strong social connections and intellectually stimulating brain activities, as well as exercise and healthy diets. Those studies, conducted in thousands of people around the world, confirmed that combining many of these factors could have a stronger effect in preventing Alzheimer's. The fact that lifestyle behaviors can have such a strong role in preventing dementia and Alzheimer's is good news, say experts. These findings are extremely hopeful, Maria Carrillo, chief science officer at the Alzheimer's Association, said in a statement. At an individual level, many people have the potential to reduce their risk of cognitive decline and perhaps dementia through simple, healthful behavior changes. At a public level, interventions based on this evidence could be extremely powerful in managing the global human and economic costs of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.